Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 project here on the Nerd Party Network. So we've come to the end of the line for now with the A24 filmography, and until those films return, we're diving into A24's television output, and in between we aim to bring you interviews with the talent involved. This week we turn our attention to one of A24's most famous and potentially divisive outputs, Euphoria Season 1. So Dallas, it feels like it's been a long time coming to get to Euphoria.
It certainly has. It's one which I'd heard a lot about, but it's one of those ones which, because it was on, I think it was HBO in the States, meant that it was very difficult to see over here. And then I ended up, once it was kind of apparent, sort of about 3-4 months into lockdown, that A24 were only going to be focusing on their merchandise for the rest of the year, that it was time to switch tack, look at the TVCs. And then I think it was on Now TV. I think I had about a month's free trial, but I had a week to get Euphoria binged, and let's just say I did it, and I'm sure we'll discuss why.
Definitely. And before we sort of dive into talking about Euphoria Season 1, we'll have A24-hour news. So it continues to be dry, but on the day this episode drops, HBO will have released over the weekend the first of two episodes, acting as a gateway to Season 2 of Euphoria, after their original schedule was thrown off by COVID. And it looks like it's going to pick up in the aftermath. Potential spoilers here for you. It will pick up after the aftermath of Rue being left by Jules at the train station and her relapse. So Dallas, before we even talk about Euphoria Season 1, are you going to be aiming to check out these Euphoria? The posters describe it as, this is not Season 2, quite amusingly. Will you be checking out these mini episodes? There seems to be a lot of mystery shrouded in what form they're going to take.
Yeah, I will certainly try to check out Euphoria 1.5 or whatever they do decide to call it, as long as it is not the trend of shows that are produced during lockdown, which is Rue and Jules and Nate and all that conversing over a Skype and basically making it really clear that none of them are in the same location and they're having to do it due to lockdown and COVID fears and stuff like that. As if they've had the chance to actually go out and film something, hopefully safely and socially distanced, of course. Depending on how it screens in the US and through, you know, any means which, you know, happen to involve the letters V, P, and N, I will certainly, I'm going to have a week off over Christmas, so I'll certainly have a lot of time to try and fit that one in, I think, in between The Mandalorian, of course.
Yeah, and with Minari being the only thing on the horizon for A24 content, we might as well take something like Euphoria 1.5.
Exactly, and the fact that Minari is going to be, well, I think as of today, obviously this is a couple of weeks ago by the time this one drops, but Minari looks to have succeeded in getting a UK distribution from Altitude Films as well, so we won't be needing a VPN or an American iTunes account for that one.
I know, it kind of timed in quite well. A few of us this morning had managed to, we thought we'd blagged our way into sort of an online virtual screening event where films like Minari and a couple of others were going to be shown to film distributors that worked in the cinema and exhibition process. In fact, you know, you kind of think, right, I'll submit my application, I'm going to pay my little fee, I just want to see Minari as soon as possible. And then you get sort of an email this morning going like, you put down that you worked at the Nerd Party. I mean, it's kind of meant to be for film exhibition. Do you work in film exhibition? And it's like, I'm going to try and go in through the tiniest loophole here. And they're like, yeah, unfortunately, it's not a press screening. So we'll make sure to refund you. So I was slightly tempered by missing out on Minari by getting the opportunity to hopefully see it in cinemas through Altitude, which is good news.
Yeah, I thought it was a player move, you know, to try and get into that. I considered it briefly when I saw you guys sort of trying it, thinking, well, I have done freelance hosting work at cinemas before. That is technically involved in exhibition. You know, promoting and exhibiting, you know, new films by new filmmakers. So I could maybe go, but then I thought it's probably not worth it. Especially now that I've seen the slightly passive aggressive emails that were sent. today.
I never took it as passive aggressive. No, I took it as quite cheerful myself. But yeah, no Minari for
it sounded
us
like there was
now,
probably
but...
quite a few people do going down that route, I think.
Yeah, so we'll kind of dive now into Euphoria season one. So created by Sam Levinson, Euphoria looks at the lives of a group of high school students as they grapple with the issues of drugs, sex, and violence. Based on an Israeli TV show of the same name, the series followed a group of 17-year-olds who spend their time carelessly having sex and taking drugs with seemingly no parental authority. In the kind of Israeli version, adults appeared in the series only rarely and were always filmed at an angle that did not show their faces. So the American adaptation was produced and written and directed in large part by Sam Levinson, based on his series of own experiences as a teenager, which included struggles with anxiety, depression, and drug addiction. And he said at the time, "There is a consistent anxiety that I think exists in this generation, and I think informed the whole decision-making process." So Dallas, when did you watch Euphoria for the first time, and what was your expectation going in? What was your initial reaction? Because I've lost all track of time, really, because I remembered on an episode maybe a year ago, maybe more than that, we had an extract from Fox News where they had like the moral shock about this kind of TV program. You know, there's 30 penis shots in the first episode, it's a disgrace, it's a shambles, you know. That convinced me to check this film out, this TV series out. I was like, I'm keen to check this out. You know, if they're outraged, it's going to be up my street. What was your expectation going in, and what was your reaction after the episodes?
I mean, I'd seen that clip and how extreme and it was for US audiences. I mean, they're always very, you know, taboo on this sort of stuff. Anything that's got sex or basically bad language is immediately condemned, but you can have as much gun violence as you want in it, that's okay. I think I got slightly confused to begin with, because I think I got the title mixed up. I thought that they were remaking initially a Channel 4 series called Utopia, but it turned out they weren't, even though the US have gone on to remake Utopia, which has then since been cancelled and will not get a second series. So I was slightly confused, but I think it sounded to me very much like this was going to be the American Skins, for anyone who is grown up in the UK and is familiar with the, I think it was like an E4 show, which had a very similar plot of teenagers sort of rebelling against their parents and taking part in excessive amounts of sex, drugs, and partying and stuff like that. I mean, it went on to, you know, spawn stars like sort of like Nicholas Holt and Kaya Scodelario, but this one was something that I'd heard great things about, but because of it being over in the States, it was one which I'd never really got around to doing until lockdown opened up the opportunity and it appeared on Now TV, so downloaded it, and I think I managed to watch it in probably 2 or 3 days. I think it was similar to Rami, which we discussed on the last full episode of this. It's one which kind of basically just hooks you in, and you get to the end of one episode and you think, okay, I want another episode. And then, yeah, you sort of end up pinching it in 2 or 3 days. And I was actually very impressed. It was the filmmaking talent involved. I thought the writing was good, but I think it was the performances are what really sort of sold it to me. I thought Zendaya was fantastic. And the whole cast, really, I think. What about yourself?
Yeah, I got a really good way to kind of into this show, where I watched it in a very traditional weekly way. You know, I think it dropped on sort of Now TV or something like that on a Monday. So me and my girlfriend at the time, we'd watch it weekly. And it was one of those ones, we often didn't have the same kind of taste in sort of TV and film, but somehow Euphoria seemed to thread her love of a bit trashy kind of drama with my sort of love of quote-unquote prestige interest in sort of TV. You know, we were both of the Skins generation. I was Skins 1 and 2. I think she was Skins 3 and 4.
I think I was too old for Skins.
Like, I was the same as you. That was my initial reaction, was like, this is like an art house, hyper-drived version of something like Skins. And I just loved it because it was kind of very unexpected how dark it would go. And I think it's one of those ones, it almost reminded me a little bit, where I, probably more kind of globally, a lot of people might see a lot of sex education in this. Another chat, you know, Netflix show, but very British, where it has a very diverse cast of people that are on all different parts of the spectrum of relationships and sexuality, transgender, part of the different communities. And I thought Euphoria kind of went for that sort of direction as well. It is slightly frustrating that it's just me and you, two cis white men, talking about Euphoria, but that's just the way things have kind of landed with scheduling. But yeah, I just thought it was a great weekly TV, and I got really hooked into sort of the, you know, the plot lines that go through the, you know, the first season. And I just rewatched the first season sort of in over the same as you, sort of 2-3 days, and it was still just as gripping the second time around. And some of the episodes that I loved even more on a repeat viewing. I thought this was excellent, and it kind of deserved its reputation of being very divisive, but I thought it was gripping nonetheless.
I would always choose to watch something that I think split opinion rather than sort of having just sort of tepid reviews. There's nothing worse than sort of coming out of a film that you know you have to review and it's like 3 stars, you know, it was okay. There was nothing great about it, but there was nothing inherently bad about it either. It's just so middle of the road, and they're the worst type of shows. I think you want something which sparks a reaction, and I think it would have been interesting to see this back in the old days when, you know, people were in the office and you had those water cooler chats about what did you make of last night's Euphoria and stuff like that. I mean, I guess we're kind of getting that at the moment with The Mandalorian, which is one of those shows which actually does drop on a weekly basis, whereas everything else is pretty much, you know, drop it all at once, binge it, and then you're like, oh, that was good, but now I've kind of rushed through it, and now I have to wait ages until the next season. You know, I thought it was great. What I really liked was the structure as well. It's, you know, we sort of touched on it with the Rami thing about how it starts off as Rami's show, but then sort of certain episodes focus on some of the minor characters in his, well, not minor characters in his family, the other characters in his family, such as the ones about his sister, ones about the mother. This had a really sort of interesting structure where, I mean, certainly from the promotional materials which I'd seen and stuff like that, it was clearly marketed as the sort of, this was about Rue was the central character, Zendaya was the biggest name. She was sort of coming off of Spider-Man Homecoming, The Greatest Showman, stuff like this. So she was the star, she was front and centre. But I really like the fact that almost every single episode was basically focusing on a different character, but you still had very expertly done the sort of overarching storylines sort of filtering on in the background. Everything was sort of connected, which I really liked, because, you know, it's set at high school, so basically everyone kind of knows everyone, so it's easy to sort of dip in and out of little storylines, but you never had to really have like a 2 or 3 minute, you know, catch up at the beginning of each episode as to where you were in the story. I thought it was pretty well handled, that, I thought.
I think what you've touched on there, and I really loved, especially about this TV show, and I'm excited to see more of, I just thought the casting was incredible. The only people I really knew going into this was Zendaya from Spider-Man. You know, this is, I think different generations will come to Euphoria. You spoke about Skins. You'll get people that are coming to this where it's like, oh, that's the girl from sort of the Disney kind of programs and so on that she was in. Like, I've never seen any of them. You know, I think I'd obviously seen Greatest Showman. That was my experience of Zendaya. And I really liked her as a kind of, you know, supporting kind of character. So that got me excited. I obviously knew Alexa Demi from sort of her minor but unforgettable appearance in mid-90s. loved her in Waves, and I thought she was excellent in this. But just like the entire casting and how they seem to kind of, I would love to, one of my sort of dream people to get onto this podcast would be like the people that were involved in casting this show, because a lot of people were kind of taken from different things. This was a lot of people's first time roles, and one of them was Hunter Schafer, you know, a trans actress that was only sort of known for sort of her kind of activism. I think she was involved in sort of like the bathroom bill in America, where there was, you know, attacks against the idea of trans people being able to use bathrooms. This was her first kind of starring role, and I thought she was incredible. You know, you kind of look through all the cast, and they're fantastic. And I loved people like Barbary Ferreira as Cat. I think most people probably recognize Eric Dane, who plays Cal Jacobs from Grey's Anatomy. You know, even weird people like Maude Apatow, you know, I was like, I wonder if she's related to Judd Apatow. Yep, nepotism potentially strikes there, Jude Apatow's daughter. Like, it was just some of the best casting I'd seen in a long, long time. And, like, it was so diverse, you know, in terms of the ranges, the roles, the ages, you know, sexualities, you know, Hispanic, white, black, African-American. It had it all in this show. It was something for everyone in a way which kind of reminded me a little bit of something like Sex Education.
It's just funny when you say it, you're talking about nepotism and we're talking about a show written and partially directed by Sam Levinson, son of Barry Levinson. But yeah, I was thinking there when you said you know, the Disney Channel kids coming to this for Zendaya, I can imagine it probably would have been a similar reaction to Vanessa Hudgens fans from High School Musical, you know, renting Spring Breakers, thinking it would be a jolly sort of party movie and then getting Spring Breakers. I could just imagine the reaction. But I agree with you. I thought Hunter Schafer was probably, apart from Zendaya, I thought she was the standout. I thought she was fantastic and I think could have easily also won an Emmy probably for supporting actress in a TV series, because Zendaya became, I think, the youngest lead actress winner in the drama category. So, and I think it's well deserved. I think she's fantastic in it, but there's some scenes, it's the sort of awful scene, I think it is at the end of episode 3, where she's sort of banging on the door of her drug dealer, who's one of those, you know, TV show slightly sympathetic drug dealers who's had a change of heart and has realized he doesn't want his friend on drugs anymore and refuses to sell her anymore, and she has a breakdown on the other side of the door. I thought she was fantastic in that, and just the sort of the whole final episode as well, which I'm sure we can go into a bit of spoilers as well, but I thought she was fantastic in that, especially the sort of train station scene where, you know, I've seen some people sort of say that, you know, Jules leaves her, but I think it's actually the other way around, because it's Rue's decision to not get on the train, and you know, just when you think you might get a happy ending, of course it turns out that, yeah, it's not that kind of show, but we should have seen that coming perhaps.
Yeah, so what were some of your favorite moments from the season? I've got a huge list here, so I'm going to give you a couple of mine. I'm going to bat it back to you, and then I'm going to touch on one moment in particular where I just thought one of the characters I enjoyed the most was sort of Kat. I really sort of enjoyed sort of her development as a character, gone from sort of this kind of slightly geeky, you know, slightly overweight, you know, well, I would say more sort of someone that struggles with her self-image than as opposed to sort of her weight, and sort of her evolution into sort of a cam girl, and sort of how she seems to try and embrace her sort of sexuality and how it all goes wrong, and trying to appease the wrong people. I thought that was a really interesting one. I mean, I loved the you know, the development of the relationship over 8 episodes with Rue and Jules. You know, how that kind of dynamic works, I thought was quite incredible. And you know, one of my kind of favorite moments, sort of, you know, on the rewatch as well, was Nate's breakdown. I'd sort of I've got copies through iTunes USA. It was like $10 or something. I was like, it's going to be leaving Now TV, I'm eventually going to have to rewatch this show, I'm just going to pay the, you know, the $10, so I've got it kind of on file. And it's mentioned sort of in that scene where sort of Nate has his kind of confrontation with his dad Cal, where they decided they were going to go all method, they were going to properly fight it out on that scene. So when they're sort of, you know, pinning each other down, fighting over the bed, like, that is them properly going at it. And it's quite disturbing watching the scene where Nate, this horrible, controlling, manipulative, you know, the antagonist really of season one, he just absolutely loses the plot. And when he just starts banging his head against this sort of flooring, that was quite terrifying to watch. And how he described it at the end, this actor, in quite an amusingly Australian accent, I must say his American accent is fantastic, was, he goes, "It was really gnarly to shoot that. I felt really gnarly afterwards, which feels like the most Australian thing on the planet to describe your character having a breakdown and having a proper fight with another actor. What about yourself? What were some of your standout moments?
I totally agree with you on sort of Kat's storyline. I thought she had a really sort of interesting arc over the series, but after, you have to say, sort of the central twisted, manipulative, abusive relationship between Nate and completely blanked on the Alexa Demi's name. What's her name?
Maddie.
Maddie. Yeah, those two. I mean, it's like from that sort of first party episode where Nate seems like just like, you know, 100%, you know, typical American jock douche. A really sort of unpleasant character, you know. He sort of threatens Jules, and she comes back with a knife and stuff like that, and shows that she's, you know, just as crazy. But, you know, he's a really sort of unlikable character at the beginning and does some morally reprehensible things, but it's his evolution sort of towards the end where you see the effect of what his dad has done and on him. Is it actually sort of, you then sort of, I guess, well, maybe not empathize, but you know, you certainly do develop some sort of sympathy for the character and, you know, what he's gone through. And I guess we're all in many ways sort of products of our upbringing and our parents and stuff like that. So I thought he was excellent in his sort of storyline going across about coming to terms with, you know, his father's sexuality and his own sexuality. I think was, you know, it deals with loads of, like, say, there's so many different issues with bringing that. You've got, you know, you've got transgender, you've got people in different stages of relationships, you've got abuse, you've got an abortion storyline, you know, you've got drug addiction, you know, you've really got it all into, to pack it all into, really, what was it, just like 8 episodes. But to feel like, you know, each single character basically has a full arc and full story along those episodes, I think is incredibly well written. And like you say, props to the casting directors as well, and to the directors. I mean, you've got Sam Levinson does the bulk of the series, but you've got A24 alumni Augustine Frizzell did the first episode, and I was very surprised to read that Jennifer Morrison, i.e. Jennifer Morrison from the likes of House and Once Upon a Time, also directed an episode, which I thought was good. You know, you've basically got sort of 3 or 4 different directors across the series, but you've got Pippa Bianco, who I think she did, was it Cher? I think she did Cher, another A24 film. So the fact that you have 4 different directors, but they all have such a great understanding of whether it's just the writing or they work together on it, you couldn't really, it wasn't as definably different in each episode, whereas something like, I keep talking about The Mandalorian, but The Mandalorian is another series which has had basically multiple directors across each episode. And yeah, you can kind of tell that each one has a slightly different tone or feel to it. This, basically all those 4 directors were working as part of a whole, and I think, and that's part of why the series was so good, I thought.
Yeah, like, I just love the cinematography in this show, and I think no episode kind of captures what made this show really stand out for me as much as episode 4. Like, I've kind of mentioned it before on our other podcasts, like, my favourite, you know, film director is Paul Thomas Anderson, and one of the most influential movies that I ever saw in terms of my, you know, thoughts on film was Magnolia. And the carnival episode, I just felt, I was watching, I was like, this is the closest we'll ever see to like a Paul Thomas Anderson hour of television. I just thought, like, the cinematography, the use of the camera with the whips and the turns, you know, even sort of the music that underscores all of this kind of different plots and threads and characters that are all converging on a single moment, it just felt like I was watching a Paul Thomas Anderson movie on the small screen. I was absolutely blown away. I just thought it just felt so ambitious for this type of show that, you know, you think of your things like your Game of Thrones, your Mandalorians, etc. You kind of expect there to be sort of that visual flair, exciting cinematography, something really special in terms of how the camera is used and, you know, really creative techniques. With like teen dramas, you're kind of used to those over the shots, very pedestrian cinematography, very kind of bland lighting.
Saved by the Bell, perhaps. That's the first thing that comes to mind when you talk about it.
Yeah, with something like this, it just felt like completely elevated teen drama. That's what we're going to go for here. We're not. It's not just elevated horror, it's elevated teen drama. And I just watched that and I just thought, this is absolutely, you know, incredible. It was just like watching Magnolia. I did you sort of get that impression from episode four, the carnival episode?
I mean, it certainly did a fantastic job of sort of like juggling all the different storylines, and sort of you'd be following some characters and then the camera might just move and follow someone else who was just walking by and stuff like that. So I thought that was great. And I think I know what you say about the sort of cinematography. You know, I think because it was an A24 sort of HBO thing, you know, they've, HBO is basically home box office, where, you know, they've done shows such as, well, I wouldn't say Sex and the City is probably comparable, but certainly Game of Thrones is something which was basically bridging the gap between television and cinema. And I think, yeah, like you say, the cinematography is on another level compared to other teen dramas, where it's very sort of static. And yeah, I mean, nothing is off limits, I think, and that's basically due to the fact that nothing is off limits to any of these characters either, you know, in terms of relationships or illegal or legal substances.
I think it's also the flair of this show, again, is elevated in a range of way. I mean, you have this incredible cinematography and design. You have animated sequences. I mean, did you expect when you started the A24 project that we would eventually come to a moment where we're watching someone's fan fiction of Harry Styles and Louis Tomlinson, I think his name is, having gay sex at Wembley Arena, like, you know, brought to life through animation? There's dance sequences, there's an Inception style moving rooms. It's just everything, like, it feels incredible how much they kind of can do on, I know it's probably got a very decent budget, but a TV budget nevertheless, for what is ultimately a teen drama show, you know. And some of the things, you know, what we see in relationships, abusive relationships, you know, falling for the right people, wrong people, some of this stuff is things that we've all kind of seen before, but they definitely add their own twist to it and elevate it through these variety of different visual and editing techniques.
Exactly. I mean, there's an old sort of screenwriting sort of book, I think, that basically says there's actually only sort of seven real unique plots in the history of storytelling. And yeah, you know, a group of kids, you know, partying, doing drugs, you know, having sex and, you know, falling in and out of love. It's not new, and it's all about how you repackage that and sell it to a new audience. And they've managed to do that, and that's through the quality of the story writing. You know, the fact that this is written by, you know, an older gentleman who is basically not in his teens anymore, but the fact that he's managed to pull elements from his own life certainly means that it feels authentic. And I never felt like any of the young characters were saying stuff that was not written for them. In comparison, I did watch the new Woody Allen film this year, and that featured, you know, the main characters were Elle Fanning and Timothy Chalamet, sort of early 20s, and these kids in their early 20s were talking as if they had been written by, you know, a white guy in his 70s or 80s. It just didn't click. What they were saying just didn't feel right or authentic, but this does. And I think that is one of the strengths of it. It never tries to be something it's not, and I think that's a credit to it. I think
I'm going to pose a question that, you know, we sort of discussed a bit on the Rami episode. Did you relate to Euphoria?
I have to say that I did not. I did not relate to it at all. Eighth grade I managed to relate to, because I had everyone has certain experiences that, you know, going to new school, trying to fit in, stuff like that. But I have to say that my wild partying days did not take place until university and stuff like that. And I've never been one to partake in illegal substances and stuff. So I have to say I didn't see myself in any of the characters in this. Maybe the character of Ethan, who sort of gets rejected by the girls and stuff like that. Perhaps, yeah, perhaps him, but the rest of it, I have to say, I didn't relate to it, but it certainly didn't alienate me from enjoying the show. What about yourself?
Ethan was as you know, here we are, as we mentioned, two white cis males, you know there's not much that we can kind of go, you know, that relates to me and my experience or things that I'm kind of going through. There was like little beats here and there and so on, you know, perhaps the odd sorrowful moment, but nothing kind of ultimately you know, relatable, which maybe is for the best, but that's the good thing though, is like ultimately we are well represented in terms of material that is out there, even within sort of the A24 filmography and TV series. You know, there's a lot of people I think will watch something like Euphoria and see themselves in it, and that's fantastic, and hopefully there, you know, that representation continues. You know, I wanted to pose this question as well, because when I was watching it through the first time, you know, it made me think on something I'd said on, I think it was the Midsommar episode, where I proposed that sort of Midsommar was potentially the most influential A24 film on sort of like online culture, where you think about sort of the imagery, the design, places like Etsy, Redbubble, you know, Midsommar seems to really have connected with a very certain type of kind of fandom. Do you think Euphoria is probably one of A24's most influential releases in terms of how people sort of discuss it, you know, designs, illustrations? You know, you search the Euphoria hashtag, it has thousands upon thousands of pictures of people that are women, that have a certain sexuality, what have you. Doing their kind of makeup, their design, their clothing, like a lot of the kind of characters in Euphoria. Do you think Euphoria has achieved that?
I think it has the potential to. I think, as you know, we just discussed, I don't see myself represented in it, but like you say, that's no bad thing. There are plenty of other films and TV shows for me to do that. But I think, like you say, with this, because the cast is so diverse, whether, you know, you've got African-American, you've got Latino, you've got gay, straight, bi, you've got transgender, and so there is basically, certainly for teenagers and young people sort of growing up, if they are allowed to watch it, and if they do watch it, I am pretty sure that most people these days will probably be able to find someone that they can relate to and see sort of see their representation on the big screen. And yeah, if Euphoria causes similar levels of fan fiction as Cat did for One Direction, then I think we're in for a good time. And I think in terms of potential for season two and the many bridging episodes, I think there's certainly, from the strength of the characters and writing, there's a lot more interesting stories to tell.
Yeah, absolutely. So we touched on it a little bit in A24 Hour News. It's probably the first time we've ever spoiled something before we dived into a topic. But the season ends with sort of Rue and Jules. They're going to head on a train on some adventure, but Rue decides that she's kind of got second thoughts and wants to stay with her sort of mum and sister. You know, she doesn't want to worry them, but Jules gets on the train. Rue is not coming, and then Rue stays behind, and Rue goes home and relapses. What's your kind of potential expectation for season two? Because there's a lot of things hanging in the air. We have blackmail cases. Amazingly, still in 2020, we have rogue CD-ROMs still on the go as well. What's your expectation for season two? And will you be watching along weekly, or will you wait till the end of its run, binge watch it before we do a podcast on season two?
That's an interesting question, because now that I've seen series one, I'm more invested in the show, so therefore I'd probably be more keen to Because like with something like with Game of Thrones or something which I wasn't watching, you would still see the discourse on a Monday morning or something after it dropped and everyone would be talking about it. Because I wasn't really following it or watching it, they could be talking about stuff and I wouldn't really know who they were talking about or plot lines they were talking about. So therefore, a lot of it would kind of go over my head and I wasn't really getting spoiled. But now that I've seen season one, there's potential that, yes, I could get spoiled, so therefore I probably will try, if it is possible to watch it as close to release date, I probably will do that, I think. As to where it's going to go, I mean, they're in a slightly tricky slot in that season one essentially begins with Rue returning to the family home after sort of being in drug rehab, and the fact that she's now relapsed at the end of season one. I hope they don't go with a, she's either in rehab or she's just back out. I think they maybe need to do a slightly longer jump forward in time or something. Or unless maybe the 1.5 will just be her purely experience within the drug rehab facility. Whether it's like maybe she's like locked in there and she's then sort of on some sort of mad, crazy, drugged out spiral of imagination and like allows you to do some more things like with the animation, the musical numbers and stuff like that, which she experiences when she's on these drugs. But I think, yeah, there's a lot of interesting stories to tell. I think, yeah, I don't know where it is going to go, but I'm excited to see where it goes. I'm glad that I'm not able to sort of hypothesize and basically guess where this show is going to go and then ultimately be disappointed when what I think is going to happen is either proved to be right or wrong.
I think it's going to be wild whatever happens.
Oh yes, it'll get the conservatives will be up in arms no matter what happens.
Yeah, there's no date obviously on season two. I know they are filming at the moment. There's been like pictures and stuff on like Instagram of like seeing them kind of filming and having the masks on, so you know, these little mini episodes, however long they last and whatever format they take, could be our, you know, our most kind of, you know, content really for a little while. But it's not going to be the end of content here on the A24 project, because we've kind of got a few different things kind of coming up. We have next week, we've got an interview with Mike Keller, one of the first of three interviews we'll have from On the Rocks. So you'll talk about his role of Officer O'Callaghan, and rest assured, there is a lot of good Bill Murray stories that we will be dropping here on the A24 project with our interviews. And then after that, we've got our first A24 TV interview, when Madison Hine will be talking about her role on Rami, on one of my favourite episodes, where Steve goes to hook up with a girl and Rami gets left alone with a very needy young woman. So that's going to be fun. And then we're going to take a little Christmas break, but before we come back to discuss Rami season 2 with Oase, we are going to drop a little Christmas special. We've been lucky enough, me and Dallas, to interview a lot of the people involved with 8th grade, from Bo Burnham to Jake Ryan and a few actors in between. And we're going to bring a little compilation episode together with stories from the set and making of 8th grade. So hopefully that'll be enough to bring you a little bit of Christmas cheer with a pretty depressing Christmas potentially on the horizon. So we'll hopefully help a little bit there. So Dallas, are you looking forward to our episodes ahead?
Absolutely. Very excited to listen to anything Bill Murray related. And yeah, I can just imagine the stories that the guy had of trying to film Bill Murray. I imagine that if there was a script, Bill Murray didn't stick to it. So I'm excited to see what that happens. And I think our 8th grade episode will be perfect for anyone who wants to dive into the world of Bo Burnham, following them catching promising young woman at, he says, in inverted commas, cinemas in the US on Christmas Day. Or let's face it, you're watching it online, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, thanks very much thanks very much to everyone for joining us, and we'll be back again in a week or two. Take care. Bye.